We're back with the Tech Policy Grind. I'm Evan Enzer, a fellow with the Internet Law and Policy Foundry, the organization where the next generation of tech law and policy professionals convene to write, think, and talk about the web, technology, and disruptive innovation. This is the Tech Policy Grind, the Foundry's podcast where we chat about what's going on in the world of tech policy. Hi, everyone. Today, I'm recording the intro because we're about to talk with Pedro Pavone, a lawyer and policy advocate focused on privacy and currently working at Meta. We chat about his career, the importance of diversity in privacy and in tech policy more broadly, and what it's like to work at Meta as a privacy advocate. Before we get to that interview, I wanted to take a minute to let everybody know that this is going to be my last episode as a regular member of the Tech Policy Grinds. Over the last year and a half, I've been the regular editor for this show and worked on producing episodes with Rima Musa as well as Daniela. But as time's gone on, my schedule's become more busy and I can't dedicate the same time to this show like I used to. I'll still be a member of the Foundry and I'll be involved with the podcast occasionally, and I hope to see you when I'm back for a future episode. And with that, we'll get to the conversation with Pedro. Well, Pedro, first, could you just tell me like a little bit about yourself and your current position at Meta, and what you do in your day to day.
Great, man. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the podcast. Really happy and proud to be here. Myself and my job. Okay, my name is Pedro. I work in privacy policy and in fairness policy, like digital fairness. And you know, those are like sort of fancy words for saying like I'm an internal and external advocate for responsible technology, right? And so within Meta, I will partner really closely with product leaders and functional leaders. Think like the legal department and the finance department and the privacy engineering team to ensure that like as we're designing, deploying, and iterating on our products, that we're doing so in responsible ways that are aligned with external expectations and the rules. Externally, my role is a little bit more advocacy oriented with respect to like Meta's interests. And what I mean by that is my team works on a lot of listening and conversation sessions with key external stakeholders to try to understand what external expectations are, inform those expectations by the way the technology actually works to make sure there's alignment there and understanding on how things actually function, and then bring signal back into the company from our external policy stakeholders to make sure that our decisions internally are being informed by what we're hearing outside. I call that like the convergence flywheel, right? Which is like really corporate-y talk. But that's essentially what my team does. I am a lawyer. I've been a privacy and data protection lawyer for a long time. My team is full of lawyers, but our job is a little bit more involved than just like providing strict legal advice to Meta.
That's really interesting. I think you just touched on this a little bit. One thing I've always thought was really interesting, especially about your LinkedIn, which I follow, and you're always on my LinkedIn timeline, is that you call yourself a policy advocate sort of first and foremost, and then a lawyer. And then you say that you're focusing on privacy. And so what goes into what goes into the way you identify yourself as an advocate and lawyer instead of a privacy professional?
Yeah, I think like if taking a narrow view of myself would be to say I am a lawyer at a corporation and I tell the corporation what my judgment or I express my judgments on what is permissible or not based on the rules to the corporation, right? That is a very narrow thing. The law says X. The law says you can do X and Y. Here's what X and Y means. Here are the things that you can do. Oh, let me evaluate what your proposals are to make sure they align with X and Y. I think there's a need for that and understanding the law clearly and making sure that you don't violate it as a company or an organization is really important. But I think my work goes a little bit further than that. It's okay, the law permits X and Y, but should we do it? Does it make sense to do it? Are there other factors in play? Should we weigh the legal permissibility of something against other interests, like our own business interests or the interests of users? Is it going to create a good experience? Is it intuitive? Is it going to create harms that have nothing to do with legal compliance? that we need to think about. Does the technology impact different groups in different ways, and maybe disparately or disproportionately impact some groups more than others in harmful ways? Like, these types of analyses of evaluations aren't just pure legal exercises, but they are sort of the bread and butter work of what I ask my team to do and what I try to do myself, which is just go beyond understanding what's permissible and try to determine what is optimal. And optimal means taking into account the interests of not just the company, but of all of our users and people are, you know, people who interact with our services.
That's really interesting. So what made you interested in these subjects of privacy policy and technology policy more broadly?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, in law school, I definitely became interested in like the government's capacity to surveil citizens in context of, particularly in the United States, of the U.S. Bill of Rights, right? And, you know, when I was in law school, it was in the early 2000s, and, you know, this was like USA Patriot Acts had been enacted. We were, the United States was in conflict around the world, you know, and like sort of counterterrorism framed scenarios around the world. And like government surveillance was a big deal. You know, in the 2010s or so, you know, Edward Snowden did his thing, which sort of continued to elevate my interest in trying to understand the intersection between like the government's absolute obligation to protect the citizens, balancing that against people's rights, particularly those clearly articulated in the Bill of Rights. So when I was in law school, this became really interesting to me. When I started practicing law, my first job was in the federal government. So, you know, I got to dabble a little bit in some of these issues, and the interest remained. When I went into private practice, you know, advising the government was obviously no longer part of my role. And so I sort of transitioned that curiosity and interest into like the commercial and corporate side of understanding the intersection between like how much companies need to know about people to deliver the benefits that people have gotten used to receiving, right? And obviously I work in the digital ad space. And so there's a lot of controversy and a lot of discourse about whether personalized ads are good or bad, and what, you know, how you use data to deliver personalized ads really matters with respect to responsibility and proportionality. And so there's some really interesting like legal and ethical and social and societal questions that pop up in the work. And it's kept me interested for, you know, it's weird to say, but like 15, 16 years now. So with no end in sight. So it's just a cool area that didn't have a lot of, you know, long-standing regulatory and legal frameworks. And so I got in kind of early, which has been good for my career, but also good for my just sort of like maintaining a high level of interest. And now I think we're just entering like a phase in the privacy and data protection space where, you know, some ideas are starting to calcify and mature, and we're going to have to test the long-term durability of those ideas as technology continues to change. So that's a long way of saying I've been really interested for a long time. I remain really interested. The area that I work in is changing constantly, and I really like that.
I think your story with privacy is pretty similar to mine. I was pretty young when Snowden and everything about the surveillance was being revealed. And I always just was very uncomfortable with it. And then when I got to law school, I was very interested. I didn't know privacy was a field at that point. And I was very interested in the intersection of civil rights, civil liberties, and technology.
Yeah.
And I used to tell people, I was like, oh, this was probably the end of 1L. I was like, I'm going to go into this thing that I'm going to do digital rights. And I sort of thought that, oh, maybe some people are doing what I'm talking about, but I'm really doing a new thing. And then as law school went on, I was like, oh, what I'm really talking about is just privacy. And this has been around for years. And so I was drawn to it from, I think, a similar place as you, and wanting to, figure out how to protect data and best serve Americans in the world through maintaining their privacy.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. I can tell you privacy was not a thing they taught in law school when I was in law school. And so you know, I had to do a lot of self-exploration and like self-study. I was lucky that I had a professor who was visiting at the University of Florida at the time. Her name is Andrea Matuition, and we're great friends to this day. And, you know, she worked in like sort of data security. She still does, worked in like the data security aspect, which has a lot of intersectionality with data privacy. And so I was able to dabble a little bit while I was in law school in a meaningful way, right? Like I took her courses and we did some independent study together, or I did some independent study under her. And it was really, really cool, and I stuck with it. It's great to see now that law schools more formally have these programs. I mean, I taught at several law schools and several universities as an adjunct, and I've almost always taught classes that are like topical around data privacy, data use, data ethics, technology in the law, which is great. It's just even 15 years, 17, 18 years ago when I was in law school, this was not the case. And now I think it's all over the place. And I believe that's a good thing.
I can say even just, I think 5 years ago when I started talking about this, oh, civil rights and civil liberties and technology, I feel like nobody was talking about it in law school. And today, like by the time I graduated law school, a little over 2 years ago, it seems like everybody was talking about it and everybody wanted to take these classes. So I think even in just a couple of years, it exploded. So you touched on this a little bit, but you've worked at a number of very large government agencies, companies, and law schools. Yeah. A few examples are the DOJ, Army, Oracle, and Salesforce. How is working in each of these environments different? What did you take away from these experiences broadly? And how did you approach privacy and technology different in each role?
Yeah, that's a big loaded question. Look, I'll tell you, working for the federal government is a very educational experience, right? I was very lucky to graduate from law school and get selected to a pretty prestigious program within the Justice Department, and so my first job out of law school was to go work at the U.S. DOJ, which is just cool, man. And I'm very fortunate for that to have happened. What you learn in government work is that like efficiency isn't always the top priority, you know, versus in corporations, getting things done quickly, going to market are always towards the top of the priority list. In government work, that's not always the case. The case is, so the work is a little bit more contemplative. It's a little bit slower. It's a little bit more deliberate. And there's a lot more continuity that is required. And what I mean by that is just lots of stakeholders with lots of disparate interests that have nothing to do with like some unifying corporate goal besides serving the American people, which, you know, sort of opaque at best if you're trying to get something done, is part of the process. So I learned early on that like, you know, work product in the government is not something that's going to happen quickly. It's easy to be frustrated by that. And there's lots of talking heads that think governments should be run like businesses, but I don't agree with that. I think it's good. There's a lot of public benefit that the government is slow and methodical and careful because the government has powers that are different than companies. Like the government can withhold your liberty and the government can take your life. And so because of the high stakes of government decision making, I learned early on that like it's easy to throw darts at the government because it moves slow, but like one of its greatest virtues is that it doesn't move hastily, typically. And so I learned that there, and I learned how to do the slow, deliberate work of like, you know, getting concurrence from lots of people, and that taught me some institutional patience. When I moved over into the private sector, you know, corporations, whether it be a gigantic behemoth like Oracle or an upstart or sort of like a cutting edge consumer facing company like the one I work at now, everything moves faster than government. Okay, everything at any corporation. If a corporation is moving way too slow, it's going to fall behind. It's not going to be competitive. So, you know, Oracle is probably it's the largest corporation I ever worked at. And, you know, it had processes and frameworks and procedures. And, you know, the Oracle way is a whole fucking thing there. But it is a very responsible sort of methodical company that has a lot of government and institutional customers. So it needs to behave in ways that are predictable and reliable because the customers that rely on Oracle, that's what they're looking for: dependability, reliability, stability, and Oracle delivers that. Salesforce is sort of like the same kind of thing, just smaller. And so the company moved a little bit faster. But while I was there, I saw it maturing into much more sort of like solidified frameworks and verifiable processes. So it was like kind of growing out of its startup phase when I was there, which is really, really cool. You know, Meta is a little bit younger than both of those companies. And Meta was founded by some young people that were hanging out. Everybody knows the story, right? You know, I'm 43 years old. The CEO of my company is in his 30s. And a lot of the senior executives that I work with very closely are younger than I am and have less, quote, formal education than I do, but they're brilliant people trying to do the right thing, and they've surrounded themselves with lots of experts. But that wasn't always the case at this company, especially when it didn't have the resources to do that. And so what I've learned at Meta is that, like, you can learn from previous mistakes. And the company has done a lot of work to behave more responsibly, to be more transparent, to improve its internal systems so that the work is verifiable, and an evidence-based approach to decision-making is an institutional part of how the company operates. And I've seen that mature quite a lot in the few years that I've been here. I think I'm on my fourth year or so. But like, so anyway, just lots of differences. I would say speed is the one that will stand out to you if you just look at it from 60,000 feet. But there are other sort of like inner workings that are unique and different. And you have to sort of curate to the environment that you're in as you deliver your work. But one of my own personal sort of like benchmark things that I think I bring that's valuable is I'm always agitating frameworks and processes and looking for new efficiencies and new ways to do things. That drives a lot of process people crazy. They think I'm disruptive or whatever. But like, what I'm really trying to do is like probe the endurance and durability of ideas, because you know, just because something worked for the last 2 weeks doesn't mean it's going to work for the next 2 weeks, or doesn't mean that it can't be made better. And so I'm constantly probing that in my current job and having in all the jobs, even when I was at government.
So I think I'm going to go from one potentially loaded question to another, because you touched on Meta there and mistakes and things that they've done to improve. And I agree with you. I will defend Meta sometimes. Meta has done some cool things, like starting the oversight board and improving the privacy of its products through, you know, very usable dashboards. And I'd also say it's maybe not the worst privacy offender in the market. It's not the one who's necessarily selling your data to anybody. It's more just using it for the advertising on the platforms. But Meta still comes under a lot of criticism for some of its practices. And I was wondering, with your identity as an advocate sort of also coming from that government surveillance, public interest background, how do you navigate that working at not just Meta, but other large companies as well? You know, also as somebody who's about to move into that side of privacy.
Yeah, it's a good question. Look, first of all, I'll challenge the idea that like using data to deliver personalized ads is, quote, privacy offensive, right? I don't think so. I think like a proportionate, transparent, user understanding and user control driven system that delivers personalized ads is not hostile to user privacy. There's this idea in the world that's prevalent, which is user privacy means people's ability to exclude others from everything. And that is not what privacy is. Privacy is about users having control over how companies decide, use and collect their information, and how governments and other people use and collect information about them. That's what privacy actually is. Like, the verb of privacy is me as a person being able to understand, engage, and exercise agency around how things around me are using information about me to drive business or government or whatever outcomes. And so I just wanted to make that point. Now, I think like your question about, you know, is Meta on a path of improvement, and like, how do I interlace or in, you know, how do I participate in that improvement path? I think the answer to the questions is yes and yes. Yes. And here's how. So like, yes, I would not work at this company if I didn't think that the company was participating in good faith efforts to be more transparent and give users more control and provide services for free to billions of people based on personalized ads that are delivered responsibly. I'd quit if I didn't think that, you know, Mark and senior leaders were aligned with that worldview. And my experience at the company has been that, like, as a champion of like user interests within the company, the company has provided me resources, provided me the platforms, and provided me the spaces to express my views and my team's views in furtherance of those things. And I don't feel censored or controlled. That doesn't mean that every decision that gets made goes exactly as I've recommended, but it does mean that, like, lots of decisions about data use and data strategy at this company are informed by feedback that I deliver, that my team delivers, and that feedback is informed by our conversations with key stakeholders, external interest groups, marginalized representatives of marginalized groups, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know of many companies that have a flywheel approach like that, that is robust. I don't know of many companies that are investing more in user privacy protection than the one that I work at. So like from that perspective, to me personally, it's very rewarding to be a participant in that work. And I think, like, you asked me how I engage. That's how. Like, I see my team's role is as a business enablement team, which means allowing the company to meet its business goals, but to do so responsibly. And I do not think, and I could not work here if I thought that delivering a personalized ad is at odds with every interest a person has, including their privacy interests. I just don't think that's true. And I think even if you think that there is a privacy cost, which there obviously is, weighing that cost against other interests that people have, like, for example, having access to all of their friends and families and things that they're interested in for free, need to be weighed against, like, absolute privacy ideas, right?
So I'd agree with you there too. I was talking about civil liberties earlier, and I definitely came to privacy from that perspective of individual autonomy. And if you want these services and you want to share your data and you want personalized ads, I know plenty of people who do. I don't think it's necessarily up to me to tell them they can't do that.
Yeah, I don't love the paternalistic sort of European view that I'm seeing in some of the rules, which is basically people don't know what's best for them, so we're going to tell them. Like, that is the spirit of, like, a lot of regulatory discourse that I hear come out of Europe. I just don't think that that is how the rest of the world thinks about this. And what that informs in me is the notion that, like, privacy is not a universal idea. People in different societies think about it differently, and companies like Meta and others that work and across the world have to take into account that there is no absolute right answer. There is a, you know, bundle of views and lots of intersecting and sort of conflicting views around privacy, depending on who you're talking to and where in the world you're having that conversation. And it's expensive and hard to take it all into account, but I think companies like Meta have a responsibility to do just that.
Well, actually, before I switch gears a little bit, I first met you a few years ago through an IAPP event, the International Association of Privacy Professionals.
Yeah.
And it was on hiring in privacy. I think the event might have been something like getting your dream career in privacy or something to that effect. And a lot of the event focused on recommendations for recruiting teams and for HR and how to build the best privacy team. How is that topic something you got interested in? And what would you recommend to recruiters who are looking to bring on the best people in privacy and related departments?
Yeah, I'll tell you real quickly how I got interested in it, because it's straightforward. My name's Pedro. I'm a Latino American. My primary language is Spanish, and I grew up in a Cuban household. I don't know another sort of prominent facing privacy professional with a similar background to mine. Not one. You know, when I first started working in this space, I looked around. I didn't see Black people. I didn't see Latinos. I didn't see almost any women. Have things improved? Yeah, a little bit. Do I sit in rooms even at my own job every day and look for a Latino and can't see one in sight? That's true. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of work still to be done. And, you know, it's nice to be the, like, loud internet social media, podcast, Latino voice and privacy. But I wish I honestly was buried in like lots of Latino voices and privacy. And so we have a lot of work to do. And so I'm a huge champion of the idea that, like, you know, there's lots of talent, untapped talent out there, and lots of untapped expertise out there that companies and law firms and government agencies can take advantage of if they rethink their hiring practices and stop looking to the same models to provide different results. That's just not how things work. And so some of the ways to do that, you know, I've talked about on other podcasts and in other forums, and like, I think people should listen in because I've got some ideas. Now, I'm not an expert in, like, you know, DEI or in recruiting people of diverse backgrounds. That's not my education or my trade. But I have some views, and I'm not too shy about them. I would love to retire from this profession and look around and see a diverse, multifaceted, like, ecosystem of experts. We're not there yet.
So you mentioned something there, and I think we'll shift gears to that a little bit. But you have a podcast called the Data Protection Breakfast Club, and you've had a lot of very cool guests on that show, like the Chief Privacy Officer of Google and the CEO of IAPP. What inspired you to get into podcasting, and what do you want our listeners to know about the show?
Yeah, well, thanks for the show plug. You can find it on Spotify, Apple, wherever. But, you know, at the beginning of COVID, I was still at Salesforce at the time. Me and my friend Andy Dale, we've been friends for a very long time, just jumped on a Zoom, like a coffee Zoom. Remember when that was the thing? And we hadn't seen each other since quarantine or whatever. He lives in Boston. I live in Atlanta. So we jumped on the Zoom and we just caught up, and it felt great. I hadn't seen my buddy in a long time. And he sort of floated the idea of, like, hey, why don't we do this again and just invite a friend and you know, another privacy friend. And I was like, yeah, let's fucking do it. And so we did it. We did that a couple of times. And then, you know, I was like, well, why don't we record these? And then it was like, well, why don't we post these on YouTube? And then it was like, why don't we post these on Apple, whatever? And so if you go way back into the archives and you listen to our first couple episodes, they're my favorite ones because it's just sort of like raw conversation with interesting people. But like the quality of those episodes, like from the production side, is garbage, right? Like we're just using Zoom. We didn't have fancy mics. We didn't have any of these things. So they sound and look kind of horrible, but like the actual content is some of my favorite. If you listen to some of our more recent episodes, like we have a jingle, we have sponsors, we have fancy equipment, we have production, we have imagery, we have all this stuff now. And so like it's come a long way. We're about to record our 100th episode here real soon. We've won some awards, like, you know, whatever. It's just been really cool. But it all started from me and my friend missing each other and wanting to have conversations with our friends, which I think is actually a good origin story versus – me and Andy deciding we want to share how smart we are with the world and this kind of stuff. If you listen to the podcast, there's not a lot of that. Like me and him aren't really going deep diving into substantive legal issues and trying to like train the world on our worldview of the legal frameworks. It's more like, let's bring somebody really interesting on, have a great conversation with them about their own story and about their own interest in the practice area. And let's talk about the issues of the day in technology law broadly. And that's what we do. And it's been a formula that seems to work. So we'll do it until we get bored or until people stop wanting to listen.
I like that story. And that explains the name of Data Protection Breakfast Club. Yep. I was never sure what the name was in reference to. And yeah, when I've listened to the show, it's y'all don't do a lot of talking about yourselves. It really is focused on the guests and what they're bringing to the episode.
Yeah.
And it is really interesting. I've learned some or heard some really cool stories from listening to your show.
I'm glad you hear it, man. Make sure you hit subscribe and give us a 5-star rating.
I'm subscribed for sure. Maybe we'll start ending the conversation here. And like I mentioned, I follow you on LinkedIn, and I saw that you just received a birding certificate.
Oh, yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about what birding even is and tell me a bit about how exploring interests like that makes you a better advocate and better professional?
Yeah, well, what a good call out. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn, and I've found LinkedIn to be a pretty good forum to share my ideas and, and some of the things. So like if anybody wants to be friends on LinkedIn, please let's do that. But Birding. Look, I worked for a guy named Dennis Ali when I was at a law firm. He's been a guest on my podcast. If you want to hear an amazing story about an amazing person, find the Dennis Ali episode of my podcast. It's about him, not me or Andy. And he's just a tremendous friend of mine and a mentor and just a brilliant person. He's been practicing law for 40 years. He knows all the things. Wow. He is one of the great naturalists you'll ever meet in your life. In addition to being a fancy corporate lawyer that he's been for a billion years, like, he is one of the foremost experts on the Florida Everglades. He's one of the foremost experts on birding in the southeastern United States. He's one of the foremost experts on butterflies. Like, mm-hmm. he just knows a lot of things that have nothing to do with, like, you know, reverse triangular mergers, right? And so working for him, I'd always, you know, I grew up in South Florida on the edge of the Everglades. I spent most of my early childhood outside in the bush, mm-hmm. in the swamp. So I've always had this, like, tremendous affinity for nature and hiking and camping and spending time in the field. And I'd never really sort of, like, thought, like, let me create a formalized framework for me to understand the spaces that I'm in. And birding is just a good gateway to being outside. That's what got me interested. He got me interested in it just mm-hmm. from a, like, curiosity about the topic standpoint. And then I realized this is just a great gateway into, like, exploring nature in more robust ways that you have more understanding and appreciation of the ecosystems and of the fragility of it all. And so when you learn about birds, you have to learn about the environment. And it's just been tremendously interesting and fascinating to me. And so I pursued it. And yeah, a couple of weeks ago, I graduated from the Georgia, it's called Birds Georgia, which is the former Georgia Audubon Society. They just rebranded. Mm-hmm. But Birds Georgia puts out a sort of master birder course, which you have to study, and it's an 8-week situation where you're pretty intensive, like two mm-hmm. nights a week. I was like taking the class and wow. showing up on the Zoom and doing the whole thing. But it was an incredibly humbling and rewarding process because I worked with people that I would never interact with ordinarily, you know, some retirees, some kids, like children. My mentor, if you will, throughout the whole process was a kid named Caleb, and he's, you know, 12 years old, and he is a unbelievable expert at, like, mm-hmm. bird identification, and, like, he taught me so much. And, you know, I'm a 43 year old lawyer working at a fancy company with a podcast, and I loved the experience of being humbled by a kid who clearly has a command of a subject that for me was difficult to navigate and to this day is still tricky. I think that really helps me cultivate a beginner's mindset, which I can bring to my actual work. Because one of the challenges, I think, when you become a quote expert mm-hmm. is you start being as open to new ideas because you think you know things. And when you show up to a birding course and a 12-year-old is taking you to school, you realize, hey, when I go to work, I need to maintain the same beginner's mindset I have when I'm talking to Caleb to make sure that I'm not, like, being dogmatic in my work and that I'm allowing room for innovation and new ideas. And that's the thing that I think I bring, that, you know, that transitions over and makes me better at my job.
Hopefully one day Caleb has his own podcast.
And oh, he will. This kid's on his way. He's going to be a foremost ornithologist or whatever mm-hmm. he puts his mind to. This kid's going to crush. So I'm excited to see his future. I hope he doesn't forget me because I won't forget him. Yeah.
So is there anything that you want to plug before we sign off for today? It could be anything you're working on, or it could be anything you're reading or enjoying right now.
I think work-wise, I think it's important for anybody listening to this that's interested in the intersection of privacy and just sort of other benefits and other rights to read and watch carefully the developments in the EU around the AI Act and mm-hmm. the enforcement methods of the GDPR by different regulatory agencies across Europe and sort of like the intersectionality between all of that and competition law with the EC and the DMA and the DSA. So, like, a lot of acronyms, but what I'm saying is if you want to understand sort of like the direction of travel and some of the challenges we're going to face in our work, looking into the cornucopia and constellation that is European privacy mm-hmm. And data protection rules is a complicated but great place to study. And I spend a lot of my time and energy trying to make sense of what's happening there. I don't agree with a lot of the sort of like general trajectory there. And and I hope more balanced ideas prevail over time. But like right now, it's just a cool, wonky place to pay attention. You know, outside of work, as weird as it's going to sound, I'm on like my third or fourth book about dinosaurs this year. Nice. And I think like dinosaurs is one of those things that captivates children, right? Oh, and it's hard like, to imagine kids not being into dinosaurs.
I bet Caleb knows all about dinosaurs.
You know, as a thank you gift for Caleb, I sent him a book about dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. So like, I hope that sparked his interest there. But like, I'm reading a lot about dinosaurs. And like, one of the things that like I've learned is that, you know, dinosaurs ruled the planet for 180 million years. And then that's a long time. Okay. And then one day they were gone, and it was through really no fault of their own. And us humans, we've quote ruled the world for maybe a couple hundred thousand years. Mm-hmm. And, unlike the dinosaurs, I think we have much more agency and capacity to be stewards of the planet and to take care of it and protect it. And I hope we take that into account as we continue to be sort of the dominant species on the planet. And I encourage us not to have to do everything we can to not have an ending like the dinosaurs. And in order to do that, I think we need to think real deeply about our own behaviors.
I completely agree. And maybe I'll plug something too. You mentioned the EU AI Act. I'm going to have an article coming out with the California Lawyers Association sometime in the next few weeks. And it's going to be an interview with Professor David Danks, who's been studying the EU AI Act and other AI laws. And I'll have that interview coming out sometime in the next, probably in the next month.
Super cool, man. Yeah. I'm excited to see it.
So thank you so much for joining the show today, Pedro. I really enjoyed talking to you and getting to know you a little bit better.
Awesome, man. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed the conversation too. And I look forward to watching you in your new role. And I'm sure you'll be successful. And I'm here to help in any way I can.
Thank you. Talk soon.
The Tech Policy Grind podcast is created by fellows at the Internet Law and Policy Foundry. It's been co-produced by myself, Evan Enzer, along with Daniela Guzman-Pena. Special thanks to Pedro Pavone for their collaboration and support in bringing this episode to air. I and other Foundry Fellows engage with the Foundry on a voluntary basis and in our personal capacities. The views and opinions expressed on air do not reflect the organizations we are affiliated with. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Tech Policy Grind. Be sure to check out the Foundry on LinkedIn and Twitter. And if you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review and give us a 5-star rating. It really helps out the show. If you're interested in supporting us, reach out to us at foundrypodcasts@ifoundry.us. You can find our email in the show notes as well. See you next time.